Setting the stage for the next legislative session, Governor Abbott proposes new sanctions he says aimed at shoring up police. That and more today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.
I'm David Brown. We'll hear more on the governor's announcement and what battles appear to loom for lawmakers, from coronavirus cutbacks to issues surrounding policing and protests. Also, a Texan brews up a beer proclaiming black is beautiful, and he says it's going down better than even he expected. With the announcement of a Supreme Court nominee just hours away, judicial philosophy and gender politics, plus the week that was with the Texas Tribune and a whole lot more. When the Texas Standard gets started, right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this Friday. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us. It's September 25th, 2020, and yesterday, Governor Greg Abbott held a news conference announcing new legislative proposals he described as aimed at protecting law enforcement officers as well as Texas communities. Essentially, it was a wish list of increased penalties and new crimes that would require jail time for certain offenses committed at protests. This is beginning to offer up some clues about the upcoming legislative session set to begin in January, so reports Dallas Morning News Austin Bureau Chief Robert Garrett. Bob, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
My pleasure, David, as always.
Governor Abbott yesterday announcing several proposals that would add new criminal sanctions for what he described as rioting and other behaviors that have been associated with some recent protests. Quickly, what's known about what the governor's proposing here, and how does this fit in with what he's proposed recently when it comes to police funding and protections?
Well, we should note from the outset that this is in the context of a campaign, and he wants to talk about riots while Democrats want to talk about COVID. He has had several, as you noted, plays on the police, defunding the police and law and order themes lately. Yesterday's was all about stopping what he said was revolving door arrests that we had seen in Dallas during the riots that occurred earlier this year. He would just basically upgrade punishments for a whole host of things like injuring property and police and hitting cops during a riot. And so it's kind of one of those things that maybe fits in the category of popular at the time, and we'll see if it leads to mass incarceration 20 years later, but maybe only if we have a lot of domestic unrest.
And so the governor's focusing a lot of attention on what Republicans are strategizing around law and order issues as they see it. But we're still in a pandemic. In fact, 15,000 Texans have died now from COVID-19 since March. And inevitably, that issue is going to be taking up a lot of lawmakers' time as well when they return for the next legislative session. How do you see this sort of setting up as we head toward that opening of the session?
Well, there'll be a certain amount of fighting the last war, and that is, you know, the battles that Greg Abbott had with some local county judges and mayors over going too far on mask orders and COVID orders. This Republican legislature will look back, I think, at the powers of county judges and during emergencies. Of course, from his right flank, Greg Abbott is receiving criticism for being overreaching, and so he'll get some criticism. So there'll be some discussion of COVID disasters and powers to shut down business.
Well, what are you hearing from lawmakers or those close to the Capitol about how the legislature might address some of these public health considerations around COVID-19 and the economic recession, too, caused by the pandemic?
Well, the budget cuts are going to be severe, so there's going to be discussions of how to get maybe some new revenue. Just in terms of the actual logistics of the legislative session, we're hearing that they are so concerned about safety that on the Senate side, they're thinking about just using two of their 16 committee rooms, and that would really narrow down how many bills could be heard if you're only using two rooms. We haven't gotten that confirmed. The leaders are very quiet about their plans, but in general, that would sort of lead to don't have hearings on bills that are divisive and not going anywhere.
I'm curious, though, because we hear from so many listeners about the rainy day fund. And the comment quite often is as simple as, if this isn't a rainy day, what is? Do you see that fund being tapped to try to offset some of these budget shortfalls?
Yeah, and you know, they generally grab some of it. It's become a hot button issue as to whether you use as much as Democrats would like. They're going to use a lot of it. But David, we have a little bit more than $8 billion in the rainy day fund after some required transfers. And this shortfall could be, you know, $10, $15, $20 billion because of the pandemic. So I think it's a given they'll go to the rainy day fund. And we may even have discussions of things that have been off the table, such as Medicaid expansion. That, of course, is if the Supreme Court doesn't knock down Obamacare before the legislature convenes in January.
Of course, there's another huge unknown, and that's whether or not the state house flips to Democrats, which is, well, many Texas Democrats certainly see it this way, a possibility, a very real possibility. Could that upset all these priorities?
Well, it would make the budget fight in particular more dramatic, because the Democrats want more spending on social programs. They want more health care access. The Democrats will fight Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick or whoever is arguing for a slimmed down agenda and coming back and doing stuff in special sessions. The Democrats, the leader in the House, Chris Turner, confirmed to me that we want a wide open agenda because our power, members' powers, are at their peak in a regular session, not in a special session where the governor controls the agenda.
Bob Garrett is Austin Bureau Chief for the Dallas Morning News. Read all about it. We'll have a link to his latest at texasstandard.org. Bob, thanks as always.
Thank you.
It's been 6 months since the Texas-Mexico border was closed to all but essential travel as a COVID-19 precaution, and the impact has been felt in both Texas and Mexico. Before the pandemic, thousands crossed the border on a daily basis. KTEP's Angela Cocherga went to one international bridge to see how people are coping on both sides 6 months on.
At first glance, you might not realize the border is technically closed. The Paso del Norte International Bridge looks busy. A line of cars waits to enter from Juarez, and in El Paso, people gather near the pedestrian entrance headed to Mexico.
It's a little bit difficult, but I try my best.
Marisol Marin is a U.S. citizen who lives in Juarez. The 30-year-old helps her parents and supports three children by working in El Paso. She brought her youngest child, a 5-year-old, with her on this day.
I clean houses over here. Yeah, that's what I do. I clean houses.
People are allowed to cross back and forth for work, medical treatment, and education. But the border remains closed to non-essential travel. Even so, since U.S. citizens and legal permanent residents cannot be kept out of their own country, some still go to Mexico for other reasons, like visiting relatives. After paying a toll, I walk towards Mexico. Halfway across the bridge, Marco Antonio Corral is peddling potato chips and water. The 60-year-old's customers are drivers and passengers stuck in idling cars, waiting in line to enter the U.S. The father of five says his sales have been cut in half since the shutdown started in March. He says, to be fair, the border should be closed to everyone, not just Mexican citizens.
Los locales no pueden pasar. Pues está mal porque pues deben de cerrar todo parejo.
Once across the bridge in Juarez, a ragtag group of older musicians plays songs for tips. Alejandra Guerrero listens as she waits in her truck to return to El Paso. She's in a line of cars that stretches into Mexico.
The most time that I have to wait is 5 hours.
The 26-year-old mother of two crosses the border every few weeks.
I come and visit my husband. Yeah.
He's waiting for a visa to join her in Texas. U.S. Customs and Border Protection discourages U.S. citizens from going back and forth to Mexico during the pandemic. Part of the strategy includes staffing fewer booths at border crossings so people are forced to wait longer to get home. At the historic Kentucky Club, a guard at the door takes people's temperatures as music blares. The restaurant and bar used to attract customers from both sides of the border. But on this afternoon, nearly all of those enjoying a late lunch are locals from Juarez. Walking back across the bridge to El Paso, I encounter Pedro Jerónimo Pérez, pushing a wheelchair with a handwritten Uber sign on it. He works for tips, helping older people across the bridge. Many see doctors and dentists in Juarez, where medical care is so much cheaper. He wears a mask and says he's careful with hygiene as he proudly shows off his big bottle of hand sanitizer. Beta says his wheelchair Uber service is still in demand. But back on the El Paso side of the border, it's a different story. Shopping is not allowed as an essential reason to cross the border. During the past 6 months, retail businesses in this city lost an estimated $100 million, according to data from the University of Texas at El Paso.
Muy despacio, o sea, la verdad, en estos seis meses nos ha afectado mucho.
Sergio González says sales at his discount clothing store declined by 75%. He's just a block from the International Bridge and depends heavily on shoppers from Mexico. González's message for U.S. and Mexican authorities, hurry up and reopen the border in time for the holiday season before businesses are forced to permanently close. In El Paso, I'm Angela Cocherga.
Wells Dunbar is our social media editor, monitoring social media on this Friday. Hello there, Wells.
Howdy, David. Well, as you mentioned, Governor Greg Abbott proposing new legislation increasing penalties for behavior in connection with what he described as riots and rioting, including mandatory jail time. If passed by the legislature next year, this slate of rules would also criminalize organizers or financial supporters of protests deemed riots, seemingly begging a legal challenge over the constitutionality of these laws. On our Facebook page, some folks expressing similar concerns. Michael Warner says the definition of a riot is too vague. We have seen time and time again when a police chief declares a riot when only a protest exists. Jesse Dorsey says if the damage or injury would not otherwise be a felony, this is all wrong. All folks would have to do would be to send agitators into a peaceful protest to create a riot. Then suddenly all peaceful protesters are suddenly felons. And Tim Davis says we are losing our rights. They're slowly being chipped away. Why not spend this time and energy to address the reasons these demonstrations are happening? Seems like a missed opportunity to win some political points. Well, that's a range of the opinions we're seeing out there, David. Got some closing in on 50 or so comments on this topic alone right now on our Facebook page. I'll be back with more later on in the show.
In fact, in about 35 minutes or so, if we haven't heard from you, look for us, Texas Standard, on your social media platform of choice. Wells Dunbar joining us once again shortly, coming up on 19 minutes past the hour. It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Beer collaborations are pretty common in craft brewing. Brewers like to team up and get creative with their recipes, but an idea from a San Antonio brewer has taken that idea to new heights, and it's doing more than just creating new sales. Marcus Baskerville is the founder and head brewer at Weathered Souls Brewing Company. He created the Black is Beautiful Stout, and it appears to be succeeding way beyond his own expectations. Marcus, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you for having me.
I understand that Black is Beautiful Stout is now available in all 50 states and more than 20 countries, and you just got this project off the ground fairly recently, right?
Yes, sir. So the actual project initiative launched June 1st. So it's been a couple of months in, but yeah, I mean, we've have over 1,150 breweries involved total, and I would say the reception has been amazing so far.
And what were you expecting, actually, when you launched this thing just a couple of months ago?
My original goal was actually set at 250 breweries.
not bad. So let's get into the concept of this. What is it that you're doing here, and why Black is Beautiful? I guess Stout, we should note, is a darker colored beer.
Yeah, so it was kind of a catalyst of a few things that led to the initiative. One was being the conversation into regards of Breonna Taylor's murder and a lot of the stuff going on with George Floyd's murder and the protests. And then, you know, having a young daughters and myself and looking back at the community that they're going to grow up in. Basically, I wanted to find a way to use my platform to contribute, to give back. And so what we ended up coming up with was the Black is Beautiful initiative, and it was a call to all the breweries to participate in a collaborative effort brewing the stout and then donating 100% of those proceeds to local organizations, foundations that support charities for inclusion and equality.
You're making available, as a brewer yourself, a base recipe, and then brewers are invited to build on that. Is that right?
Correct. So we provided a base stout recipe that's really easy to follow for breweries that don't particularly brew stouts. And then for those who wanted to be creative, obviously, because we don't want everybody releasing just the same beer, we left a creative platform open for breweries to add their own ingredients, adjuncts, and get creative with the recipe.
Tell us a little bit more about how you came up with the name for this concept.
Yeah, it was actually a kind of no-brainer once I figured out that I was going to do a stout. And you look at the general hues of the stout, and it can range anywhere from like a milk chocolate brown to the deepest colors of black. And you look at some of the current situations that are going on in our society, and, you know, we just literally wanted to make that statement that black is beautiful.
We should talk a little bit about the community, because there is a real community of brewers in Texas and way beyond, too. But as I understand it, it's like so many other industries, dominated by white males, right?
Correct. So, I mean, you look at Texas, and there's over 350 breweries in Texas. I'm the only black brewery owner in the state, also the only black head brewer. You look throughout the United States, and we have over 8,500 breweries, and there's less than 60 that are black owned. So we definitely are in a minority situation within the brewing industry. But one thing that we can say, that based off of how this initiative has gone and the amount of breweries that have participated in Black is Beautiful and even taken the extra steps beyond brewing the beer and donating money, is that the brewing industry does have the opportunity to be inclusive.
So do you have any hopes or hops about where this could all wind up next?
So I'm hoping that it just kind of continues to grow and people catch on. Again, like I said, there's 8,500 plus breweries in the United States, so we've only hit a small fraction of them. The ultimate goal is to keep this initiative riding, keep the movement riding, and hopefully more people join in when their production schedules kind of allow them to do so.
Marcus Baskerville is head brewer at Weathered Souls Brewery in San Antonio. You can check out the Black is Beautiful beer at more than 1,100 breweries. Marcus, thanks so much for speaking with us on the Texas Standard.
No, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Support for Coverage of Business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with essential workers who are out there working safe and keeping Texas strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Earlier in the broadcast, we talked about Governor Abbott's moves to raise penalties and create new crimes for actions during protests. And on Wednesday, the Dallas City Council approved a budget that largely leaves police funding intact. The backdrop to both of these moves are nationwide protests over police violence against people of color. When the city of Austin reduced its police department budget last month, Governor Abbott's reaction was quick and negative. Peniel Joseph is the Barbara Jordan Chair in Ethics and Political Values at the LBJ School of Public Affairs. He's also Professor of History and Founding Director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy at the University of Texas at Austin. He calls Austin's move the opening salvo in national efforts to reimagine public safety after the police killing of George Floyd.
Efforts to transform the criminal justice system have grown since the Black Lives Matter movement erupted in 2014. At the grassroots level, calls to defund the police that seemed marginal, even outlandish, then have taken on a new level of political maturity in this year of racial reckoning. Defund the police advocates do not literally advocate getting rid of law enforcement. Instead, they argue that over the past half century, America has overly invested in systems of punishment. These systems reinforce anti-Black racism, segregation, violence, and premature death at the expense of imparting justice. The phrase defund the police might be better characterized as reimagining public safety. This is what the Austin City Council, pressured by the heroic work of local racial justice organizations, essentially did with their recent budget. By infusing new resources into mental health, ambulance services, and non-lethal first responders, the city council followed the lead of groups around the country demanding public investments in BIPOC communities. That's Black, Indigenous, people of color, rather than investing in more police. Enter Texas Governor Greg Abbott, who's backed the Blue initiatives, threatened to coerce political leaders and local municipalities into passing ever-increasing police budgets against even the pretense of supporting racial justice. Abbott's plan would represent a state takeover of Austin police, an act that flies in the face of the local control from federal intervention, most often touted by political conservatives. Even worse, such a bill further fans the flames of racial division in Texas and nationally by irrevocably placing Black lives and public safety as two mutually exclusive issues. Abbott's Back the Blue plan recalls the era of massive resistance, a euphemism for white supremacy that greeted the civil rights movement's heroic period after the Brown Supreme Court decision. Confederate politicians signed loyalty pledges supporting racial segregation. Thousands joined white citizens' councils that were devoted to maintaining Jim Crow, and states resurrected Confederate battle flags to announce their symbolic resistance to Black dignity and citizenship. The governor's efforts are both morally reprehensible and politically indefensible, but have historical precedent. But so too the dogged efforts by millions of Black Americans, often joined by a small but robust plurality of white allies, to end systemic racism, defeat white supremacy, and in so doing, finally achieve our country. Expanding our definitions of citizenship, freedom, and democracy requires a fundamental shift beyond the status quo. Reimagining public safety is an important first step in this regard, one that should not and cannot be halted by the forces of political reaction whose perspectives echo the worst aspects of our nation's tragic racial history.
Peniel Joseph is the Barbara Jordan Chair in Ethics and Political Values at the LBJ School of Public Affairs. He's also a professor of history and founding director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy at the University of Texas at Austin.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. The U.S. government executed its seventh inmate of the year last night for a 1999 double murder in Texas. That's after President Trump pushed to resume the federal death penalty after a nearly two-decade hiatus. Christopher Villalva, a 40-year-old Black man, was convicted in the killing and robbery of Stacy and Todd Bagley at Fort Hood when he was a teenager. Villalva's mother, Lisa Brown, spoke hours before her son died via lethal injection in Terre Haute, Indiana. She apologized to the Bagley's family.
My son wants you to know that he is deeply remorseful for the pain that he has caused you.
That audio is courtesy of WTHI-TV. Villalva had previously called for his execution to be halted because of his young age when he committed the crime and racial disparities on death row. According to the Death Penalty Information Center, 45% of federal death row inmates are Black. Texas is for the first time offering online voter registration for citizens when they update their driver's licenses. A federal judge ordered the Department of Public Safety to offer the option by this week to comply with federal voting laws. Mimi Marziani heads the Texas Civil Rights Project, which sued the state, arguing it was violating voters' rights by only offering in-person registration at DPS offices.
The state has been fighting us tooth and nail on this issue for a number of years. But this is the first time that they have rolled out a public system, made all the necessary technological changes to open that up.
The Texas Attorney General is expected to appeal the court order. Texas is one of nine states that does not allow all voters to register to vote online. Four Texans are part of a congressional delegation visiting an immigrant detention center in Georgia Saturday, where multiple women say they were given hysterectomies without their consent. The Democratic U.S. representatives include Joaquin Castro, Veronica Escobar, Sylvia Garcia, and Sheila Jackson Lee. And the University of Houston football team will not take the field Saturday, marking the team's fifth game that's been either canceled or postponed due to COVID-19. Houston Public Media's Matt Harab has more.
The Cougars were supposed to play North Texas, but four Mean Green players tested positive recently, so they backed out. This has happened for every game U of H has tried to play, except its opener against Rice. U of H athletic director Chris Pesman says he understands the safety concerns, but is disappointed for the players. Houston is supposed to play Tulane on October 8th.
Matt Harab reporting, and I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from the Texas Department of Agriculture. Because of educators and school nutrition professionals, over 5 million Texas children have daily access to nutritious school meals, many including local products. Learn more at farmfreshfriday.org.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. When asked when there will be enough women on the U.S. Supreme Court, the late Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg is famously known for saying, when there are nine, noting that no one's ever raised a question about nine men. It does seem President Trump will nominate a woman to replace Ginsburg on the bench. Amy Coney Barrett, a judge on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit, has emerged as a front-runner on President Trump's short list. If nominated and confirmed, she would be the fifth female ever to serve on the high court. Renee Kanaki Jefferson is a law professor at the University of Houston, and she recently published a book called Shortlisted, Women in the Shadows of the Supreme Court. Professor Jefferson, thanks for joining us again on the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me.
First, some thoughts on Justice Ginsburg's legacy and the shoes that her successor will have to fill.
Well, it's an extraordinary legacy, both the work that she did on the Supreme Court, the work she did leading up to her time as a civil rights lawyer, and of course, how she had such an impact on women's lives for generations and a real cultural influence. Just one example I'll give you. Often she was most powerful in her dissents, and the dissent that she wrote in the Lilly Ledbetter fair pay case, even though she did not command the attention of the majority of the court, Congress heard her, and the first bill that President Obama signed in when he became president was to, in fact, do what Justice Ginsburg called for in that dissent, which is to create a law that would allow for women to have fair pay, equal pay for equal work to men.
Well, let's talk a little bit about a name being mentioned as apparent front runner to replace Justice Ginsburg, Amy Coney Barrett. What's known about her judicial history and why does she seem to be leading the pack?
Well, we don't know much about her judicial history because she was only appointed in the fall of 2017 by President Trump. Before that, she was a highly regarded law professor teaching constitutional law and other subjects at Notre Dame. So it's hard to know very much about her judicial philosophy beyond what she talked about in her confirmation hearings and that process and then what we've had over the past few years. She is certainly thought by feminist groups to be certainly a more conservative nominee, but it's impossible to predict with any certainty how she will decide a particular case if, in fact, she ends up on the U.S. Supreme Court. Although I imagine if she is the nominee, she will get lots of questions about that in her Senate confirmation hearings.
Yes, the issue of abortion seems to be what a lot of people were focusing on during her earlier confirmation. I'm curious, from your standpoint, how do you think a pick like Barrett might, well, I think, play out among women voters? And just how much of a consideration is that for a president in an election year? It's got to be huge.
Well, that's absolutely right. And President Trump is not the first to run a political campaign based on a Supreme Court shortlist. Ronald Reagan most famously did so when he pledged to give the country its first female justice, and he did exactly that after the election, giving us Sandra Day O'Connor, the first woman on the U.S. Supreme Court in 1981. Before Reagan, Nixon did the same thing, putting two women on his shortlist in 1971, Sylvia Bacon and Mildred Lilly, never intending to actually put them on the court. He would say things in the Oval Office like he thought women shouldn't be allowed to vote, but he wanted their votes. And so he at least pledged to consider them. Trump's following that same pattern and certainly mindful that women voters are going to be paying a lot of attention to who he nominates for the court, and it matters.
Well, this is a question, because is it possible that this could in some way backfire? You nominate a woman who perhaps, you know,
quite often, some people tend to think of the nomination of a woman as if women were monolithic in their opinions about, you know, where the court should go. And there's been a lot of criticism about how Barrett might move on that issue of abortion and other issues being a conservative.
You've raised an important point in this question. Just because a woman goes to the Supreme Court doesn't necessarily mean she's going to represent, I don't know, what one might stereotype, feminist values. And part of the problem here is the reality that we've only had four women on the Supreme Court compared to hundreds of men over time. And what is important to me in my research and scholarship is that we have more women on the Supreme Court, in the federal judiciary, and generally in positions of leadership and power across all professions that represent a wide range of perspectives and backgrounds. I think that in this case, part of the concern we're seeing is that Justice Ginsburg was absolutely a feminist icon. And so there's a lot of uncertainty and concern and indeed even fear about what it means for the court going forward if someone who doesn't share her perspective fill that seat, especially on decisions that were very close, those 5-4 decisions where one vote can make such a difference.
Renee Kanaki Jefferson is a law professor at the University of Houston. Her book, Shortlisted, Women in the Shadows of the Supreme Court, was released earlier this year. Professor, thanks for joining us on The Standard.
It's been a pleasure to be here.
It's The Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. DJ Pierce, famously known as drag superstar Shangela, was nominated for an Emmy this year for her reality TV series We're Here, which she co-hosts. But with the pandemic, alas, she wasn't able to walk the red carpet. What's a girl to do? Hang out in Paris, of course, and let the red carpet come to you. Only in this case, we're talking about Paris, Texas. And the red carpet? Well, Vogue magazine rolled it out big time for Shangela in a hometown photo shoot, gowns, high fashion, and all that glitters. Seldom has the local DQ appeared in such a glamorous light. Shangela, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Well, hallelujah, and thank you.
I said hometown there, but I know you have a home in L.A. Tell us about the connection with Paris, Texas.
Well, I grew up in Paris, Texas. Honey, I'm a Texan through and through. I graduated from high school here, from Paris High, and I come back very often because my grandmother and my mother, my family, all live here in Paris. And now since the pandemic, I've been living here for the past 7 months, working from Paris.
Wow.
And being close to my family.
What made you decide to come back home? I mean, Paris, Texas is a little smaller than Los Angeles.
Ooh, the good country cooking. Why else? No, I'm telling you, I had to order a treadmill from Amazon and set it up in my grandmother's garage because I have been eating very well since being home.
Seriously, though, were you just wanting to hang with the family during quarantine, or what were you thinking?
Yeah, you know, it just made more sense for me to be here closer to my family and ride out the wave. I mean, this is the longest that I've been in my hometown, you know, consecutively since I graduated high school. So it's nice to have this moment with my family.
What was it like growing up in Paris, Texas? I mean, especially with your larger than life personality.
Ooh, well, I'll tell you that when I was growing up, I was thankful that I had a family that never really pushed me to hide who I was. You know, I grew up with a Southern Baptist grandmother, and so there were those challenges with coming out and being an out loud and proud gay person, but just being out loud in general, my family pushed me and supported me. They definitely encouraged me to pursue every avenue of my personality, and I'm thankful they did because, you know, I never stopped.
I think it really pushes back against a lot of the stereotypes of Texas. And although, of course, those stereotypes, there's more than a grain of truth for a lot of young Texans mm-hmm. who grow up here. But when you mentioned that you were going back to Paris to some of your colleagues back in Hollywood, did you see any eyebrows kind of go up like, what you're doing what?
Well, you know, because of the Botox, many eyebrows in Hollywood are not able to go up anymore. But I will say... My friends definitely told me they were going to miss me. They don't know the joys of Paris. So look, there isn't a huge amount of visibility, or at least there wasn't when I was coming up, for an LGBTQ person. So people think like, oh my gosh, you're going back and you're going to be, you know, shrouded into this small town again, you poor, poor thing. But I love my small town. I really enjoy it. And I think the really cool thing about being someone who is on a show like We're Here, which highlights the LGBTQ experience in small towns, to be someone who's from a small town like that, I get to come home almost, you know, I don't know how many people say this, but in my heart, I feel like a hometown hero, even if it's just to one or two people or a couple people in my family, you know? And also, I think the way of thinking in our town has evolved, or at least grown, so that there's different ways of thinking. And I feel like I have even more of a place here right now. So that's why I'm so honored to be able to celebrate Paris, whether it's in photos or, you know, an Emmy red carpet backyard celebration, or just in going to my local Walmart.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I want to get to the photo shoot in just a moment, but so that people who are perhaps less familiar with you understand, you started your career as a contestant on the second season of RuPaul's Drag Race?
That's where I started my career, in front of the camera. Before that, you know, I went to SMU in Dallas. After graduating here, I worked in PR for TGI Fridays for like 2 years, and then decided, you know what? The cubicle life works for a lot of people. It wasn't working for me. And I really wanted to pursue my dream of being an entertainer. So I saved up my money, packed up my Explorer, and headed out west. And of course, I ran out of money within the first 6 months. But then I landed as a contestant on RuPaul's Drag Race Season 2. And then I was the first person to go home. I thought I was winning. I'd only been doing drag for like 5 months. I went on the show, and within 2 days, I was back at my house, and I was like, what have I done? You know, I quit my job to come here. Have I completely gone down the wrong path? But I didn't let that moment stop me. I kept pressing forward. I worked really hard. I competed. I got little jobs here and there. And then I was invited back on the show for Season 3 of Drag Race. And then I really took off after that, thankfully.
Counting yourself, Texas has been represented by some pretty heavy hitters in the drag world. Queens like Asia O'Hara, Alyssa Edwards, Kennedy Davenport, just to name a few. I wonder, do you think that there's something about Texas queens that sort of sets them apart from the girls in, say, New York or the West Coast?
Well, I love all those girls, and I think there's something about Texas drag and how we do drag in Texas, in the South, that really does set us apart from anywhere else in the world. And I've traveled all over. Look, I did a tour of 184 cities around the world in 2018 alone. I've seen some drag, okay? But I love Texas. That's where I first got my love, when I went to Dallas and saw the Texas queens performing there. You know, a lot of it was rooted in elegance. You know, there are lots of different types of drag, and I've learned how to celebrate all of those and embrace them. But what I grew up on was watching these beautiful illusionists go on stage and perform and represent such, whether it was pageantry or it was just a different style of elegance and entertainment. You know, you got to be a really good queen to make it in Texas, and that's what I love.
Yeah, that's great. Now let's get to that photo shoot. Where did that idea come from? I mean, taking Vogue to Paris, Texas, but I mean, really, I guess really Paris, Texas to Vogue, because you're using the Eiffel Tower landmark. I love the idea of having the DQ behind you. That was epic. It made me double up.
Well, you know, this is my very first time being a part of a show that I'm hosting that I was nominated for an Emmy. And 2020 has been a rough year for a lot of us. It's brought a lot of challenges, and it's taken away a lot from us. And I was thinking, you know what, 2020, you are not taking this Emmy moment away from me. I'm going to celebrate, even in my own little way, socially distanced here in Paris, Texas, if I have to. So Vogue came along a little late. The idea with Vogue came along a little later. I went to a local party rental place here in Paris. I rented a red carpet. We called the local graphics place. We had a step and repeat made. I told my grandma, look, we're all getting dolled up and we're going to walk this red carpet. And I was very thankful that I had friends that were local in Dallas that came down, masks on. And we decided to go around Paris and let's highlight some of these amazing places. I just wanted the photos for my Instagram. And then later, and I was so happy, you know, Christian Siriano, who's an amazing designer, a lot of people know him from Project Runway. He's a friend of mine. I told him, Christian, I would have loved to have been rocking one of your dresses this year on the carpet, but don't worry, baby, because I'm still doing my own photo shoot. He goes, oh, you are? Well, I'll send you some gowns. And he overnighted me two of his amazing gowns from the runway. So here I am, and you know, my fabulous Christian Siriano couture, going around to the local fountain and the Eiffel Tower, the local pastures, just taking pictures. And they turned out so well that Vogue ended up picking them up and running. They loved the story. So it's so cool. Like when I went to take the carpet back, the people in the red carpet place were like, oh my gosh, we saw us in Vogue. They wanted the pictures to hang on their wall. Because their red carpet and I and Paris was all in Vogue magazine. Fabulous.
It is a fabulous photo shoot. We'll have a link to the piece over at texasstandard.org. She is the pride of Paris, Texas. DJ Pierce, famously known as drag superstar Shangela, thanks so much for taking time out to talk with us on the Texas Standard.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Long live Texas. Hallelujah.
This is Sean Petrie of the Typewriter Rodeo, and we make up poems on the spot on old typewriters on whatever topics people give us. Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Pettiness is easy. Lying is easy. Inheriting privilege, being macho, bragging, all easy. What's hard is standing up with humility. What's hard is being strong with grace. What's hard is doing what you know in your heart is right, when so many others sneer. I met you once, smiling, witty, and hunched. Not with age, but I think with carrying the hopes of so many. And now you're gone. But we will still carry that hope. Though it is not easy, it never is. I'm Sean Petrie with the Typewriter Rodeo, and you're listening to the Texas Standard.
Support for the Typewriter Rodeo comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
The Typewriter Rodeo runs on listener suggestions. If there's an issue you'd like to hear put into poetry, let us know on social media or email texasstandard@kut.org. Then make sure to join us each Friday right here on the show or anytime wherever you get your podcasts. Fridays on the Standard also mean it's time to check in with the Texas Tribune for the week that was in Texas politics. Alex Samuels is political reporter for the Trib. Alex, welcome.
Yes, always happy to be back.
Good to have you. Governor Greg Abbott this week hit back at protesters with a handful of new legislative proposals. We were talking a bit about that earlier in the show, but let's talk specifics. What's going on here?
Yeah, so in Dallas yesterday, as you mentioned, the governor issued a string of new legislative proposals to raise penalties and create new crimes for offenses committed at protests.
Give us a taste, if you don't mind, such as?
Yeah, so such as creating felony-level offenses for causing injury or destroying property during what is deemed to be a riot, and felony offenses for locking hospital entrances and using lasers to target police. Striking an officer with something like a water bottle, for example, would also lead to a mandatory minimum of 6 months in jail.
Very interesting, and it gives us a sense of where the legislature may be headed, at least in terms of possible political battles. Meanwhile, Governor Abbott's in the crosshairs from his own party because you have Texas Republicans suing him over early voting. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, so Abbott, as you mentioned, is facing a lawsuit from prominent members of his own party over his extension for early voting for the November election and his expansion of the period for voters to submit mail ballots in person. So the plaintiffs argue that Abbott needs to consult the legislature before making these decisions, and they imply that a special legislative session is needed.
So Governor Abbott appears to be getting pushback from both sides. Texas Democrats, of course, who aren't too happy with his emphasis right now on law and order and the way that it appears to be sort of aimed at some of the larger cities, notably the city of Austin and to some degree Dallas, but also fellow Republicans on the right. Where does Governor Abbott stand as we approach that legislative session starting in January?
Yeah, so it's important to note that Abbott isn't actually on the ballot.
Absolutely,
this,
yeah.
Yeah, so he's making this an issue for a lot of candidates who are running down ballot. And of course, he has this back the blue pledge that he's asking all members of the legislature to sign. So it's becoming, you know, the sort of issue of, you know, do you support law and order, or, you know, do you support these, you know, quote, riots? And I think that's going to be a big sticking point between Democrats and Republicans just going into 2021. But of course, as you mentioned, the governor is getting pushback from members of his own party, you know, state party chair Alan West, ag commissioner Sid Miller, over some precautions he's taking over the coronavirus pandemic, such as extending the early voting period. So he's kind of getting it from both sides.
Yeah, but we can't let you go without asking about TikTok in Texas, a popular social media app on the verge of being banned from download in the U.S. Now it may be headquartered in the Lone Star State. What's the deal?
So the president said last weekend that he had tentatively approved a deal between the TikTok company and Oracle and Walmart that could bring the joint ventures headquarters to Texas, but that deal faces a lot of uncertainty over how many jobs it would bring to Austin versus the world, and basically how China and America would retain those business relations.
Whole lot of unanswered questions here, but you can keep up with the latest over at texastribune.org. Alex Samuels is a political reporter there. Alex, thanks. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Monitoring social media on this Friday. It's Friday, y'all. It's a well done bar, social media editor. Amen to that. So what are folks talking about on this Friday?
Well, we're hearing from folks about stories on today's show. I know, big surprise there. But lots of folks chiming in about different things. Eric J. Smith noted that really interesting story about the Black is Beautiful beer collaboration. Really cool initiative there from those Texas-based brewers. And Eric notes that that Black is Beautiful beer is not just a statement of support. It is delicious, although we would do good to ask him which version he did have, as the recipe is spread far and wide. And apparently there's over 100 different takes on it so far. Very cool story. I'm kind of sensing a little bit of a theme here as Nathan de Lacretaz finally recalls his bygone days at the Kentucky Club, that Juarez watering hole we heard about in Angela Corchada's audio-rich, just wonderful story there about the situation at the border between El Paso and Juarez. Nathan recalls that Corchega, excuse me. Nathan recalls that fancy oak bar and the bartender there who would do little coin tricks. And it's a really wonderful place for those in the know, for folks from El Paso who have had the pleasure of experiencing those times at the Kentucky Club. Really wonderful story there from Angela Corchega. And just a really impactful story for so many people in the borderlands that have that difficulty getting back and forth.
Yeah. Shout out to our listeners on KTEP in El Paso. Yeah, she did a terrific job with that story.
Mm-hmm. Scanning the headlines here. Lots of stuff. You know, the news obviously never goes away. Interesting headline here from the AP. Biden's low-key campaign style worries some Democrats. And none other than Texas Democratic Party Chairman Gilberto Hinojosa chiming in here about the former vice president's somewhat lax campaign schedule. He says this excuse proffered by the Biden campaign that he wasn't traveling because of the pandemic was, quote, a pretty lame excuse, saying, I thought he had his own plane. He doesn't have to fly commercial, he went on to say. So sort of dovetailing with some of these questions we've seen nationally about Hispanic support for Biden and whether or not and why it isn't as robust as one might expect it to be. So definitely a question hounding the Democratic presidential contender here in the home stretch.
Yeah, it's my understanding we're going to be talking a lot more about the Latino vote on the next broadcast of The Standard. That happens on Monday, but we got a weekend between now and then, and we hope yours goes terrifically, if that's a word. Terrifically? Sure, it's a word. We're out of time, but you can keep up with the news over at texasstandard.org. Until Monday, I'm David Brown, wishing you a wonderful weekend.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington family. Would your company or organization like to be a sponsor as well? Contact your local station for opportunities within your community.
For statewide sponsorships, visit texaspublicmedianetwork.com.